It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasured hands
to take you in the sun to
promised lands,
to show you everyone it's the time of the season for love.
What's your name?
Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy? Is he rich like me? Has he taken any time?
Any time
to show you what you need to live?
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why
I really want to know. It's the time of the season for love.
To talk with George Norrie, call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
It sure is, and we're going to take your phone calls this entire hour now with the author of Lonely Planets, David Grinspoon, planetary scientist. So we'll be right back with David and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. David, you had an opportunity a couple of years ago to witness Dr. Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project event, right?
Yeah, I did. That's right.
Now, going into it, I'm sure you were kind of skeptical about what was going on. After you heard some of the people who talked, government witnesses specifically, how did you feel about that and what they said?
Well, it was really a kind of puzzling experience for me, and I have to say I found it disturbing because, you know, it's very easy, I think, for somebody who hasn't been to a meeting like that, who's skeptical, to say, well, you know, to dismiss it and say, well, you know, all these people just must be nuts. But, you know, I went to the meeting trying to be open-minded, but, of course, having the mindset at the same time of a skeptical scientist. And I heard all these people testifying about experiences they had had, things they had seen involving crashed saucers or, hidden government programs having to do with extraterrestrial encounters. And a lot of the people seemed to me to be intelligent and seemed to me to be sincere. They didn't seem like they were just making something up.
Right, or anything to gain.
Yeah, not necessarily anything to gain, although for some of them I would say...
Some, yes.
...that there were subtle ways in which they had something to gain. Not necessarily they were trying to make $1 million, but some of them seemed like sort of lonely old people who were now maybe getting a lot of attention because of this.
And okay,
so you
I
have
understand.
To wonder, you know, I mean, it's subtle what people's motivation
is. Notoriety, probably.
And it's not necessarily that they're consciously seeking that. So, you know, I'm skeptical, so I try to think of all the reasons people might have, you know, for saying things.
Sure.
But I have to admit, actually being there, I found it puzzling and disturbing. And the point where it kind of crossed over the line for me was when... some of the witnesses started talking about secret discoveries of large alien structures on the moon. And that was where I felt like now they're talking about something that I know about because I've studied the moon and I've seen the pictures. And they're talking about things which I'm sure aren't there. And so You know, and I can't say that about some of the things people were saying. I can't say that I have proof that that they weren't there. But when some of the people started talking in the same sincere tone about things that I knew, I felt like I knew weren't true, it kind of, you know, changed my perspective on the whole thing a little bit. And I started thinking, well, you know, I don't know what all these people have seen, but I know that at least some of it's not true, and that made me more skeptical of the rest of it. And I have to say that...
Could pictures, though, have been hidden from you, for example, so you weren't allowed to see some things? Is that possible?
Well, you know, anything's possible, George. But yeah, there's a famous statement by Bertrand Russell, and I'll probably screw it up if I try to paraphrase it, but he said, when one admits that anything is possible, one must quickly add that some things are much less probable than others. And in my view, the moon has been so well photographed, and I don't think that, I really don't believe that parts of it have been hidden. I think there's so many people that are obsessed with poring over the moon, and certainly the side of the moon that faces the Earth has been well photographed by amateurs who have quite good equipment these days. You know, I don't think, you know, there's this whole question of, does NASA have these big conspiracies? Having worked with NASA and worked at a NASA center, I don't believe that NASA could keep any really huge conspiracy, any huge secrets, because I just, honestly, I don't believe that there's that much loyalty. You know, I think that a lot of people who work for NASA have sort of a marriage of convenience with NASA, but they're not... you know, they're not. It's not like the Federation in Star Trek, where everybody's sort of like sworn allegiance to it. You know, I think that if there was some dramatic thing that was known about it, would leak out in the time it takes for somebody to type it into an email and hit send. That's how long the secret would last.
Do you?
That's just my view of the NASA culture of having experienced it.
Do you believe it is possible that we have been visited by extraterrestrials here?
Yes, I certainly believe it's possible. I think that you know, again, going back to what we were talking about in the last hour, that that anybody who claims that they can use science to put limits on the capabilities of an alien intelligence that's you know, had technology for billions of years, they're fooling themselves. And so therefore, you know, I think that it's quite possible there are interstellar travelers in our galaxy. I'm almost certain there must be. And therefore, you know, and as we've already discussed, there probably have been species on other planets that have been intelligent for, you know, that were intelligent for billions of years before our star even formed. And who knows what their capabilities are today, and why haven't they been through this part of space? You know, and if they have, maybe they have not left traces that are so obvious that...
And maybe we are who they are.
Well, that's an interesting one, too, you know, that certainly the idea that that some advanced species might choose to seed life and to encourage intelligence throughout the universe doesn't strike me as impossible. I mean, I think soon we, even with our fledgling technology, soon we will have the capability to seed life elsewhere. And we're such babies, you know. So what is a much more advanced species than us capable of? And when does a species get so advanced and so in control of things that they might have the ability or the desire to seed intelligence elsewhere? I think that, you know, we can't rule these things out, and there's a certain logic that says that it's almost inevitable that this is happening.
To the phones we go. Wildcard line, get us started. You're on the air with David Grinspoon. Hi there.
Hello, this is Mike in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, George and David.
How are you?
How's it going?
Good.
I was in Louisville recently for a, there was a big planetary science meeting there recently.
Yeah. I heard about it, but I didn't get to go to it. Well, you basically answered my first question I have, too, which was, the first one was, do you believe that you know, extraterrestrial life could have bred with human life and possibly have, you know, mixed offspring out here that are, you know, human and of alien descent.
Well, you know, my first reaction to that, with my kind of skeptical scientist hat on, is that it seems extremely unlikely that species from two different planets could actually breed together, two species that evolved on separate planets, because what are the chances that their biochemistry, their genetics, anything about them is going to be so physically compatible that they could mate? I mean, even on Earth, separate species that, you know, have so much in common and have evolved on the same planet can't reproduce together. So that doesn't seem likely to me, but there's a far-out variant of that doesn't seem impossible to me, which is that if some, again, hypothetical, very advanced species were to come to Earth and study us, they could certainly figure out our genetics, and they could mess with it if they wanted to. And that could even, you know, again, you know, we're going far out here now, but that could even involve inventing other genetically similar but non-identical species to humans and breeding them. You know, personally, I don't see any evidence that anything like this is going on.
What about
I think that we can't say it's impossible.
What about our cloning technology we have today? That's a good example of what could be, you know, where did we get all this technology from? My second question was this, kind of pertaining to the same thing. Do you think that alien or extraterrestrial life could be spiritual beings in a bodily form? And I'll take my answer off the air, and you guys have a good night.
Okay, Mike, thanks for calling. Spiritual beings in a bodily form, David.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting one, because, of course, we can start to answer a question like that, you have to start getting into definitions of what the heck do you mean by those words. But my short answer is, to me, there's an interpretation of those words where I would say the answer is yes, because... you know, I define spirituality, I mean, and, you know, I'm not the Dalai Lama, I'm a scientist, okay, but I define it as that sort of sense of connection with not just something greater than ourselves, but in fact with the entire universe, and not just in some abstract way, but to me it's a very real sort of appreciation that, as we were talking about before, that in a certain sense the universe is, I believe, a conscious entity, and spirituality could be seen as the sort of internal realization of that. And so if you think about, you know, the possible future of humanity if we survive, or the long-term future of some very intelligent species as attaining ultimate knowledge of the universe through science, and attaining ultimate self-knowledge of the universe through what I would call self-knowledge, of, you know, internal knowledge of themselves, of their own consciousness, through what I would call spiritual progress, then, and through that very advanced knowledge of technology and spirituality, achieving some state of being where, you know, where you're less dependent upon your own physical body, because you've uploaded yourself into a computer, or you've genetically engineered yourself into some very different kind of creature. Yeah, there's a certain way in which I could see that advanced creatures would be, what did he say, spiritual creatures in an embodied
in a bodily
form.
Yep.
Doesn't, you know, I mean, again, you know, it depends on what, maybe what you mean by that isn't what I mean by that, but there's a way in which I could see that describing the way things are.
I think the universe is alive.
I agree with you there.
Yep.
I agree with you. I see the universe as a living being that is gradually becoming more intelligent, more conscious, and more self-aware. And, you know, that may sound like a far-out thing for a scientist to say, but to me it's compatible with what we're learning about the fact that there are planets elsewhere, and that surely on some of them there are creatures evolving and becoming intelligent and increasing the overall intelligence of the universe through that separate process on different planets, which I think ultimately will merge as you know, the intelligences move off of their home planets and get to know one another and form some galactic superintelligence, you know, and maybe that's already happened and we're just not clued into it yet.
First time caller line, welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead. And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Manhattan, New York. My name is Ray.
Hi, Ray.
And
Ray.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on the possibility of building atmosphere processing center to alter the atmosphere on the moon of Titan. You think that's possible?
Well, yes. My immediate reaction first would be, why would we want to do that? But maybe you're thinking of changing it ultimately to be to a place where humans could be more comfortable. But certainly I think we can develop the technology to engineer planets. We're not there yet, but we're at the point where we can at least conceive of that. And of course, it's much more common for people to think about wanting to do that to Mars, to terraform it and make it more Earth-like. And to me, there are some big ethical issues with that, because these planets might be inhabited, and we don't want to go and, it's sort of arrogant for us to change a place to be more comfortable for us, where there may be some other biosphere we're destroying. But I think that in the long run, we'll learn how to do these things, and if we establish that one of these planets, like Titan or Mars, is completely uninhabited, then to me, the ethics of the equation really changes, and I say, sure, why not? In the long run, we could have some fun changing some of these planets around and make them more useful, not just for humans, but for life.
Wouldn't it take millions of years to terraform a planet?
Well, not necessarily. It depends on how you do it. The best way to terraform a planet is to use biology itself. Either find organisms that can live and implant them. Again, we're assuming that we've solved the ethical problems and we've decided this is a good idea and we're maybe dealing with a world that's completely dead. You could either use organisms or even create organisms, genetically engineer them to alter the environment, and then it doesn't have to take millions of years, because organisms, of course, are self-multiplying and can multiply exponentially and can potentially change things fast. And in fact, this has happened, by the way, in Earth's history, that that life has changed the planet. The reason why we have an oxygen-rich atmosphere is because Earth has been terraformed, in a sense, by bacteria.
True.
And by organisms that created that oxygen. So it's been done, in a certain sense.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're up with David Grinspoon on Coast to Coast.
Hey, George Norrie. How you doing, Dave?
I'm wonderful.
Hi there.
Everyone is fine.
Long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm calling from actually Salem, Oregon. I actually have a comment about what you guys are discussing about the technologies and if we, had got them from an advanced race. My grandfather, he now resides in Tucson, Arizona. He used to be an Army intelligence officer way back in his day, and he was best friends with a Army scientist officer around the time of Roswell, New Mexico, and he used to tell me that how all of a sudden we went from, transistor radios, laptop computers in your hand, was from wreckage that they had found and studied. And they got their top scientists and figured it out. And that's why computers were so big at first, because, they figured it out. But until they started getting the process of how things, worked and making it smaller and compact, and more easier for people to use at home, that's how it started out. At least that's what I was told, And
yeah, well, I've heard similar stories before, that there are these, what some people perceive of as, these sudden and seemingly unlikely leaps in technological development, in our own technological development, that, some people attribute to, either alien intervention or what you're describing as, alien technology that's been sort of captured and what they call reverse engineered,
right,
where you take the machines apart and you figure out how they work and then you learn something. It's a little bit like, these stories of, the ancient Egyptians couldn't have built the pyramids by themselves, and so they had help, only it's sort of applying that to very recent technological history. I'm just not convinced by that. Some of the stories, the most famous stories of crashed saucers and so forth, turn out now to have been indeed government cover-ups there were actual cover-ups, but a lot of them were clearly now, you know, that it's come out of actually secret military projects, not involving aliens, just involving classified stuff. And certainly Roswell, which is the most famous example, seems to me, I'm convinced that it was, you know, there was a cover-up, but they were covering up Cold War military experiments. And I don't see the advent of computers and the miniaturization of computers as anything so miraculous. I see it as, you know, there's a lot of ingenious technology there, but, you know, transistors, microchips, these things were invented in, you know, in Bell Labs and in Silicon Valley. Maybe I've just been brainwashed along with everyone else, but I've, to the extent that I've studied it and talked to people and learned about the history of technology, it doesn't seem to me that there's this magical step that needs to have been contributed by, you know, captured alien technology. That seems a little far-fetched to me.
We'll be back in a moment with you, David. Don't go away.
See the lonely man there on the corner. What is waiting for? I don't know. But he waits every day now. He's just waiting for someone to show.
Call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free, 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
On our next Coast to Coast program, Scott Corrales will be my guest as we talk about the very elusive chupacabras. Looking forward to that one. Hey, by the way, the tiny unseen life forms that live in Yellowstone National Park's most extreme environments still guard some secrets, but they gave up one not too long ago. Their energy source for themselves, and they're very primitive, happens to be hydrogen. They live off of hydrogen, and that could change arguments they say about other life forms in the universe, such as extreme environments. So think about that. Hey, the Filament Book Club would like you to get a free electronic book when you become a member of their book club. How do you do that? Well, you can go to their website, which is www.filament.com, or call this toll-free number, 1-888-95-E-BOOK, 1-888-95-E-BOOK. Back in a moment. David, in your career, when you peered into the universe through a telescope, what was the most fascinating thing you think you've ever seen?
Is that I've actually seen myself through a telescope?
Yeah.
Or can I include photographs and other less direct...
Oh, okay, I'll give you photographs, too.
Because I
maybe
would
through
have
Hubble
to,
or something.
If we're talking about the most amazing thing I've seen, I've seen myself through a telescope, I would have to say Jupiter through the eyepiece of a 60-inch telescope, which
Jupiter?
Is not something
really?
People do very often. Usually with telescopes that big, you just hook up equipment to them. But it looked like it was like Jupiter was hovering right in front of you in space, but it was like 100 feet across, right, when you're standing right next to it. And you could just feel the swirling of the gases, and it was just so real and so close that I felt like I was on another world. That's just one random memory that was sparked by your question. As far as the most amazing thing I've seen, including using instrumentation, I'm tempted to say the brand new pictures of Titan from that Huygens.
Yeah, that's
probe.
Pretty dramatic.
Those first pictures when we came down through the clouds and looked at that landscape, and in this utterly alien place, we saw such utterly familiar forms that looked like rivers and the coast of California. To me, that is just—it's amazing. It's like—it's really like a parallel Earth. You know, it's this very dreamlike, surreal sense of another world in the old-fashioned sense of almost like another Earth, except for it's real. We've got the pictures to prove it.
Let me tell you what has fascinated me. When I saw a picture, remember when they aimed Hubble right into the darkness of space?
Mm-hmm.
You could see nothing with the naked eye, and all of a sudden you saw all these galaxies that were out there.
Oh, yeah.
That was dramatic.
Yeah, the
me.
Hubble Deep Field. You know, that's now that you mention it, that's right up there. And I could have easily, if I thought about it a bit more, come up with, you know, the same image that you're remarking on that you found so striking. Because that Hubble Deep Field, when, like you said, they pointed it what to us looks like an empty spot
mm-hmm.
in space, but you look far enough away, and it's full of galaxies everywhere you look.
Just that little spot.
Yeah. And that spot, someone described it to me like this. I think it's a nice way of thinking about it. If you took a pencil lead, not the whole pencil, but just the lead, the thin inner part
mm-hmm.
of the pencil, and you held that at arm's length, and you were looking through that tiny tube, that's the amount of the sky that you're seeing in that Hubble Deep Field.
And there were hundreds of galaxies in that
exactly.
picture.
Exactly. And so that implies, you know, any direction you're going to see that, and it just verifies this sense that that we live just in this incredibly vast universe, and that there are so many places that something could happen, that almost anything you could imagine must be happening out there somewhere.
How many stars in a galaxy, roughly, David?
Hundreds of billions. Our galaxy has probably 300 to 500 billion stars.
Unbelievable.
And that's just one galaxy.
So that little tiny pinpoint of hundreds of galaxies had hundreds of billions of stars just in it by itself.
Yeah, easily, yeah.
My God. Let's go to the phones again. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes, sir.
Hey, this is John from Indiana.
Hello, John.
Happen to be rolling through Pennsylvania.
There it is. Positive proof that he's a truck driver.
Yeah. Couple quick notes. The impending retirement of yourself and the end of my calendar happened to land on my son's 21st or 23rd birthday. And have you heard about the doomsday comet that's supposed to hit, I think, 2027?
2029, maybe?
2029? Well, that'd be my daughter's 41st birthday.
Yeah, but I don't think it'll hit.
You don't have to worry because that one...
It's going to miss.
It's going to miss.
Yeah,
there were a few days there where it looked like it could hit, and it was pretty exciting. but we, they did better observations of the orbit, and that one's going to miss. But eventually one's going to come along that's not going to miss, and so we're going to have to learn how to go up there and push them around.
Right, yeah, I'd heard both ways, and I just thought it was kind of ironic. My kid's birthday then.
Yeah, well, you can tell her not to lose sleep over that one.
Will do. I also happen to agree with your guest David there that I think we ought to go back to the moon, and I think we ought to build a space station there, because it seems like all of them that we built and put into orbit seem to fall down eventually. And I think if you build it on the moon, I don't think it's going to fall down on us anytime soon.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, and I think there's a lot of really good science and a lot of really good exploration that that we can do on the moon, that we have to do on the moon if we're going to do our job as an intelligent species and explore, you know, and learn about our past and our neighborhood. That we have to go back to the moon. Absolutely, we have to build stations and we have to explore the landscape a lot more.
I agree with you there. I think it would also make an excellent launching pad for further space exploration myself.
Yeah, I agree, and you know, I'm still hoping that I can go myself, but they better start building these things pretty soon.
I hear that. And one more quick question, and I'll take the answer off here. What do you think the possibility of alien life being what we consider angels, and in the past the ancient gods and so forth, who may have come to Earth and genetically altered the primitive man, and therefore eliminating what, you know, the missing link that we just can't seem to find?
Well, that's a pretty wide-ranging question. The first part it reminds me of an earlier caller's question about this question of could advanced aliens be sort of spiritual creatures embodied in some sort of embodied form? And I have to say that it is striking to me that when science fiction writers and very far future thinking scientists try to imagine the capabilities of super advanced technologies, they always end up with creatures that start sounding like angels. I've noticed this.
They
do.
Exactly.
That, you know, even really hard-headed thinkers like Arthur C. Clarke and Carl Sagan and Isaac Asimov, people like that, you know, when they started talking about, well, really far future creatures, you know, they will have solved a lot of problems that seem to us like they would require magic with super advanced technologies, and who's to say that they won't be able to pass through walls because they'll have learned so much about quantum mechanics that they'll know enough about matter to be able to do things like that, and who's to say they won't have, I mean, it seems obvious that you could technologically design something like telepathy by, you know, we're almost there, I think, and you know, so all these things that seem sort of magical to us, some very advanced creatures will have figured out how to do, and they might seem like angels, I think, when we meet the aliens, you know, they might be indistinguishable from what people would call angels.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi.
Hey, this is Jill in San Diego.
Hi, Jill.
Hey. The way that you talk, well, I have a real very Christian background, but the way that you talk about the consciousness of the universe going into, you know, a consciousness of God, I don't know, to me it sounds so much like the Buddhist type religions. I just kind of want to hear what you guys think about that.
Well, I actually agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think on spiritual questions, you know, we have to respect everyone's beliefs and backgrounds as long as they're not trying to blow us up as an order from their deity. Then I don't respect them. But barring that, you know, I think there's a lot of latitude for different kinds of beliefs, because it's really beyond the kind of thing we can really verify with science. To me, it's interesting you should say that, because I've said a little bit in this conversation about my sort of spiritual beliefs and how they mesh with my scientific beliefs, and I don't feel that articulate about it because I'm trained as a scientist. I'm not a theologian, but to me, the degree to which I understand Buddhism, some of the ideas really do mesh with my thinking about very advanced creatures. This idea that that the universe could be becoming a conscious entity through the evolution of advanced intelligence in many places. I think you're right. There is a sort of Buddhist tone to this. And I've actually discussed this with some friends of mine who are Buddhist scholars, and they say, well, yes, of course. And there's almost an arrogance that I think some Buddhist monks have about this question. When you're talking about aliens, they say, well, of course, We've known that all along. We've always believed that the universe is full of intelligent creatures, and they're almost like, well, what's the big deal? Why are you even bothering to think about astrobiology? Because the answer is obvious. You know, we know that they're out there. That's often a Buddhist response that I get.
And are you able to put the Buddhist and the Christian together in some way? You said that it's good to respect all of them. Do you put them together somehow?
Well, I see some, again, you know, it's like I'm not a religious scholar, but I've thought about these things. And actually, in my book, Lonely Planets, there's a whole chapter. The final chapter of the book is called Astrotheology, because I think that when you think hard enough about extraterrestrial intelligence and the possibilities of very advanced life, you run into questions which are scientific, but they're also spiritual. And so I do try in that astrotheology chapter in Lonely Planets to address, you know, what I think is, you know, this sort of the ultimate common ground between science and religion. And to me, there is a commonality between Christianity and Buddhism, and it centers around the principle of compassion. From what I understand about, Jesus is said to have said, there was a lot about compassion and love for fellow intelligent creatures. And Buddhism is all about compassion, one of the basic tenets of Buddhism. In fact, it's interesting to me that when you talk to Buddhist scholars or read their texts, they don't just talk about compassion for all human beings. They always talk about compassion for all sentient beings or all sentient creatures. And that's in the language of Buddhism going way back centuries, is this notion of other sentient beings, not just human beings, but the idea of other sentient beings in the universe. So, I guess that notion of compassion is where I would see the common ground.
Jill, thanks for your call. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. Thank you for calling. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes, sir. Hi.
Good morning to you. What a fascinating show. I have two questions about the moon. When I was growing up, my dad had a set of encyclopedias, and one of the pictures in the encyclopedia showed one of the the oceans on the moon having a bridge that had an architectural design. And since I've grown up and moved away from home, and he's gotten rid of the encyclopedias now, but he and I have not found any other pictures that showed that bridge since then. And I'm wondering, your guest, if there is any recollection or knowledge about the bridge I'm talking about.
You're talking about an actual creation, an engineered structure, a bridge. You're not talking about some rock formation or geological structure.
It looked exactly, it was concentric. It had an arc of bridge centers and support structure. And, of course, it was taken from a wide-lens telescope from Earth. I mean, these encyclopedias must have had a publishing date of, you know, somewhere in the late 50s, 60s.
Yeah, you know, I have never seen a picture like that. I sure would be interested. it's not creating a vivid image in my mind of something I've seen. And I'm trying to imagine what that would look like, seen from directly above a bridge.
I remember the picture and looking back and reflecting upon it, because it really took my breath. It was one of the key things that held that got my interest in the sciences and celestial sciences is the observation. And it was just a little off kilter, you know, at the angle. It wasn't straight down shot, and it was a picture that was evidently taken under a full moon, and it was enhanced right at the zone of this one of these natural form like an oceans, and I can't remember which ocean named it was now. And it just had these arcs, you know, there must have been, I don't know, 40 or 50 of them that stretched and made a bridge across one of these oceans.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what to say. I've never seen anything like that. I've never seen any structure on the moon that looks like a large engineered structure like that. I have seen engineered structures on the moon but they've been engineered by humans, and they're little. But I don't deny the possibility that we could find artifacts on the moon, and I think that as we've been discussing on the show, we need to go back and explore the moon a lot more carefully. And while we're exploring scientifically, we should keep one eye open for the really exotic findings that are possible.
Right, and another thing is that here about 3 years ago, perusing the internet about the moon pictures, and one came to my immediate attention, and I think that Hoagland had pressed this picture in. I think I might have got it from him, his site, showing something akin to like a caterpillar track across the face of the moon that came out of the dark side, across the face of the moon, and back down to the dark side again. Do you have any recollection about that photo?
No. Again, the only tracks I've seen on the moon are the ones that we made with Apollo. But I would certainly love to see something like that. If you find it, email it to me. But I have not seen anything on the moon that looks like tracks.
Great mysteries of the mind, though, David, huh?
Yeah, for sure.
The Lonely Planets book. How do you get it?
Well, it's newly out in paperback, and it's in a lot of stores, Barnes & Noble, those kinds of places. You can also, of course, go to Amazon or any of your favorite online booksellers. You can link to it from my site, lonelyplanets.net. And by the way, if you're interested in this subject matter, you should check out lonelyplanets.net anyways, because there's a lot of, I keep adding content, links to pictures of other planets and links to information about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and there's a whole large section of images that are related to Lonely Planets, more images than they let me put in the book. So if you're reading the book and you want to see more illustrations related to the subject of extraterrestrial life, check out lonelyplanets.net, and you can almost look along at the images as a companion to reading the book. So there's quite a lot of juicy stuff there if you're interested in this whole question of alien life.
And a couple websites for David, funkyscience.net and lonelyplanets.net as well. Hey, David, thank you for the very enlightening night tonight.
Oh, it's been great fun, George. Anytime. I've really enjoyed talking to you and talking to the callers as well.
Great. We'll have you back again. See you, David.
Take care.
David Grinspoon, planetary scientist. For Dave Caprita, Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition, the Chupacabra Night. Until then, be safe, everyone.